You're listening to Fanboy Versus with your hosts, JD Church, Chris McFeely, Chris Triplett, and Brian Kilby.
And you are listening to Fanboy Versus. I am your host, JD, joined by Nicole, Chris McFeely, Chris Triplett. And hey, Brian Kilby.
I just wanted to talk All-Star Superman.
Yes. Well, yes. Secretly, see, our show is produced, and Brian is actually producing our show now. So he was actually here last week,
I'm awesome.
Nobody saw him. So, you know. Anyway, he's here this week. He's going to talk to All-Star Superman, like we said. This week, it is Fanboy versus the Undiscovered Country, as apparently all of our comics deal with death this week. So at least mine did, all four of the comics that I read. So we'll be talking about, of course, that means Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, couple of other things, and then, like I said, All-Star Superman as well. So with that, I guess we'll get to some of the news, which also deals with that.
Yeah, something of a theme at play this week. Yeah, the only news that's really worth talking about this week is the rather sad passing of writer Dwayne McDuffie this past Tuesday. You might not be a name you'd know, a fairly underrated writer who you didn't see on a lot of titles. Most recently done runs on Justice League of America, solid run on Fantastic Four post-Civil War. Famous for creating the Damage Control series for Marvel, and probably like the most legendary, his legacy will be the creation of the Milestone imprint, the DC Comics imprint to promote diversity in comics, which gave us Hardware and Static Shock and things in the early 90s. And through Static Shock, he went on to work, he created that cartoon series, and he is probably, I suppose at this stage, just really most famous for masterminding the Justice League cartoon and just making it as good as it was. And even your little ones will still know it. Well, they may not know him directly, but they'll definitely have experienced his work, because he has been the executive producer, head writer for the Ben 10 series since it was reinvented with Alien Force going forward. And yeah, he passed away this Tuesday from complications following a surgery on Monday. 49 years of age, and it just really came out of nowhere, and real bummer, frankly. It's just a terrible shame.
Yeah. If you watched an episode of Justice League or JLU and it was good, he wrote it.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, if you were a fan of the Justice League cartoon, you were a fan of Dwayne McDuffie.
Yeah.
And he wrote the his last project has been the All-Star Superman animated movie, which we will be reviewing later in the show, and which came out on Tuesday, on the very day that he passed, which is some kind of tribute or testament or irony, however way you want to see it. So gets us off to a poor start this week. But
It doesn't get much better from there.
No.
Sadly.
No, it does. It does.
I mean, it does in a sense, and that's why we say I think it's a tribute, and in a sense, as far as, like, we are going to be talking about All-Star Superman, and which, you know, I mean, it's Superman, but it's goodish. We'll be. I'm sure others liked it better than I did, but I'm not a good, you know.
It's a faithful interpretation of the best superhero story of the last 30 years, JD.
It's a very good interpretation of it.
We're going to be talking about it. Okay.
Let's leave that till later.
Right. We'll get to that.
I suppose
in
other far less important news, there was the report that Powers, Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Avon Oeming's Icon series, has been picked up for a pilot from FX, I believe it says.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you much more about it than that, but
I don't
we'll see
know
how
anything
it goes.
About Powers.
I read Powers at one point.
I know all of it, but that's about it.
Superhero CSI is the theme of it, and it's yes. So that's certainly a thing that's happening.
Yeah,
that's
news.
Great.
And another bit of news that we actually missed last week, but it is actually about comics, so I always feel we should try and report some comic news if there is any, is more Fear Itself teasers have sprung up online in the last 2 weeks, focusing on this Who Are the Worthy tagline that Matt Fraction teased for us a while back whenever it was announced. We've seen five images of groups of three characters crowded around fallen hammers. They're not Thor's hammer, but they're obviously intended because, you know, whosoever hold this hammer, if he be worthy. And you've got groups of three characters fighting over these different hammers. But they're really strange mixtures of groups. Like, you've got one group is Iron Man, Bucky, Captain America, and the Grey Gargoyle.
Awesome.
I know, you know, that gets my attention. And then there's Colossus, the Thing, and the Hulk. And I'm going to have to look up the others, though, I'm afraid. I'm not doing
it. Wasn't, like, Dracula in one of them?
Dracula and Storm and someone else, yeah.
Yeah. What the hell is going on with this series?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd be interested to see if any of these are actually going to be in the series itself. You know, Juggernaut, Kid Loki, and Hercules, Giant Man, Absorbing Man, and Miss Marvel. And where's the other one? The other one is Dracula, Storm, and the Red Skull. So that's curious.
Seems like I saw another one somewhere. Oh. You know, when there was one in the Spider-Man issue.
Yeah.
What was it? Oh, well, that was just one of the previous five we'd seen.
Skull. Oh, was that one of the previous five? Okay. I hadn't seen that one.
Was that one with Red Skull?
This one here? Yes.
Nom, 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 nom.
No, this one was with Iron Man with a bunch of dudes in power suits.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's one of the... yeah, I don't think I saw that one before. Do you fear the legacy you'll leave behind?
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, that was one of the earlier designs. I mean, these ones that I was just describing, they haven't appeared in comics yet. They've just been on the internet so far. We'll be seeing them in the comics later. Suffice it to say, I think Fear itself definitely has my interest off the back of all of these teasers and things. Interested to see which way it goes.
Yeah, I want to read it.
This is starting...
Prologue is next month, before. And then it starts in April itself.
April, okay, cool. So about the same time as Flashpoint, War of the Green Lanterns, and... Yeah, okay.
Too many crossovers.
I know, there's going to be... it's going to be a crazy summer, per usual. But we'll be here, Fanboy Versus, covering the whole thing.
Guiding you through it.
We ought to cross over with, like, another podcast and, like, fight them.
We can do that.
I can make that happen.
We can make that happen. So one thing I want to mention real quick before we get into reviews, because some of you may have missed it. I did talk to Troy Hickman this past week. As I mentioned, Troy was the creator for Twilight Guardian as well as Common Grounds, which was actually drawn by Dan Jurgens and some other artists as well. So it was a really fun interview, really cool guy. So if you got like 30 minutes or so, sit down and listen to it. It's pretty cool. He talks about some of what Into Common Grounds as well as Twilight Guardian. So it's a fun listen. It was kind of revealing. One of the interesting reveals for me is that he has a habit of wandering around his neighborhood at like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. So it's kind of awesome. But anyway, there you go. So check that out. So any other news, anything we get to before we get to all of the upbeat reviews?
Nothing
that we
I can think of. It, everything pretty much overshadowed in just about every respect by Dwayne's passing.
All right.
So,
well,
yeah, I think that's about it as far as the news goes.
Get your Kleenexes ready, and here we go. Triplet, you're up first.
Well, not so soon. I mean, I'm not going to do Amazing Spider-Man first. I think I'm going to get Action Comics out of the way first. Then we'll get to Amazing Spider-Man. But, okay, so I read Action Comics number 898. Ooh, look at that. Can you see it? Ooh, look.
Ooh.
Yeah. Oh. And this is, I think there's one more issue left, I think, in the Lex Luthor storyline. I think 899 is the last one. And this is the issue with Lar Flees in it. And it's okay. I mean, I liked the issue. It was pretty good. I mean, I thought it was decent. But basically, the reason Lar Flees is in it is he's... it basically looks like he's trying to get a hold of that power that Lex has been trying to get, that Black Lantern power, the orbs and all that junk. But one thing I want to mention is that, man, Lara Flees just does not look right. Can you guys see that? See that image of him?
What?
Ooh. Oh, yeah. What's going on there?
I don't know, but maybe no other artist can draw him except for the one that's doing Green Lantern. Who's doing Green Lantern now? Is it
Doug Mank?
Is it Mank? I don't know. I think maybe only the Green Lantern artists can draw him because he just does not look right in this issue. I had to do a double take on it when I looked at it. I was like, is that really him? Yeah, that's him, all right.
I mean, but I know that he has those side chop things, but they're never that pronounced. I don't.
I mean, doesn't he have like a doesn't his snout stick out longer too? I mean, he looks like he has like a normal.
Yeah, it seems very
face.
Short there.
Yeah.
It's just on the end of a snout.
I wasn't sure if it was me or what, but it just looked weird. But yeah, so this, you know, still just continues the storyline where Lex is trying to get that black power, and you know, we keep finding out some more information about it and finding out that he's getting close. I think at this point he's got all of the orbs he needs to find it or activate it or whatnot. But Lara Flees wants it, you know, of course, because, you know, he wants everything. He found out about it, I guess, at the end of the last issue, and now he wants it. And so he goes after Lex, and they don't really have, like, a fight, but Lex does something to him to try to, you know, kind of, like, knock him out or something using his power suit. Yeah, there it is. Ooh, he's got lightning powers or something. I don't know what it is. And that doesn't work too good. So Lara Flees, you know, he's trying to convince Lex to give him access to the black power. And so he kidnaps one of Lex's security guys here and, like, threatens to kill him and everything. He refers to the security guy as one of Lex's constructs, you know, because Lara Flees has his constructs made from the orange lantern energy. And Lex is like, you know, he's like talking. He says, well, it's a fine point. I gave him his uniform, tools, to find some of his personality through my organization, you know. So he like goes after him. And basically Lex goes after him because he doesn't want to save this guy's life. He just wants to let Lara Flees know that he has no power over him. And instead of saving this guy's life, you know, Lex just shoots him in the head. Lex is just a bastard. I mean, that's just what he is. Yeah. And, you know, it's basically just, you know, a scuffle between him and Lara Flees throughout the issue. It's kind of a fight issue with a little bit of talky in between. And going back to, like, the issue that Joker was in when they had the orb that was inside of his cell in Arkham, it has some sort of, like a portal. You know, like, people can go into it and it takes them someplace else. Lex just knocks Lara Flees through it once he activates it, and Lara Flees winds up in Antarctica. And you get kind of a funny comment out of Lara Flees, like when he shows up outside of Antarctica. He says, oh, you don't like that. He says, they have some more, whatever you are. And he's like, it's like he's talking to something that was inside of the orb. And Lara Flees says, "What? That is what Luther wants? No, he must be mistaken. Nobody would want that. I don't want that." And Lara Flees just has to think for a second, and he goes, hey, I do not want that. There is something. Hairless Lex Luthor gave me something after all. And then he flies away. Back to Green Lantern, I guess.
So the
issue ends where Lex is, instead of, he could activate the black power from Earth, but he, being Lex Luthor, he wants to go into outer space. He wants to witness it when he activates it. So he goes into space, and I'm not going to spoil the last page, because I think the last page is the best part of the comic.
Only good part of the comic.
Oh, come on. The comic's not bad. It's just there's been better issues of it. But on the last page, when Lex is going into space to get the black power, it's revealed who is basically controlling the Lois robot, and it's pretty
badass. Don't ruin it. Don't be ruining it for me.
It's worth buying it just for that.
Yeah, because it was pretty awesome. That was the part when I was like, that is awesome.
Yeah, I gotta have to try and not be spoiled on that for approximately 6 months. So,
so it was, you know, a decent comic. It's not been the best one of the Action Comics, but it's still been pretty good. I liked it.
Nice.
Now on to Amazing Spider-Man. Look at that cover. Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Nothing says like this is an important issue than a white background. You know?
Negative space cells.
Yep.
It does. So
did everybody get to read this issue? Did everybody check it out?
Yep.
Yep.
I still need to read Spider-Man.
Oh, yes. You definitely do.
I just listened to you guys talk about it. I guess I could put it on my list.
I guess...
This is... I don't even know how... I mean, there's no way... you have to see it. I mean, this...
Yeah.
Like, this is one of those things where it's like, I don't even know how to review the first half of this. You know,
anything that we say about this comic will not do it any kind of justice at all. No. This is this even with you know even for everybody looking at the video, those of you listening in podcast, there is no distinction here. Us holding up grainy images of a few of these pages does now, no is justice.
This, is this the start of the death of campaign?
That's Ultimate Spider-Man.
No, that's Ultimate Spider.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
This is basically just kind of like what happens like right after the end of the story with the Spider Slayer and Scorpion, which you know we talked about two shows back, was it, or three?
Yeah.
I can't remember. Marla Jameson died, and this is basically what the characters are doing, how they're dealing with the death of Jonah's wife, and It's very similar to Fantastic Four. Honestly,
no,
yeah.
Not,
how it starts.
It's a silent issue, but that's about
concept,
it.
Concept, but not
in execution. It's totally different. Totally.
Well,
different.
I mean, like as the issue starts, like I kind of like you thumb the beginning of this issue at the same time while you know, looking at Fantastic Four because I was thinking two death issues on the same day. What in the heck? And then I thought, well, wow, they're doing the same thing. I mean, it's a silent issue. A character has died, a major character has died, and to kind of get that effect across, they're basically just doing you know, the panels of art showing how the characters are you know kind of dealing with it, but there's no words over the panel you know over the art, which is great. I mean, whenever they do it, it's been done you know several times before, but whenever they do it, I always fall for it.
I like it.
Well,
if it works.
It depends. Like, it has to be done right. I mean, it has to be an artist that can put it across.
And I think this artist.
It also
really
takes
did.
A. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, but I think it also takes a writer that's able to explain what they're wanting to say visually.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how to, I mean, in a sense, it's like because these are the same, you know, because these are together, it's almost like my inclination is to try to review Fantastic Four, you know, and compare the two. I want to try not to do that. But it's like, for me, if I had to pick which one is better, it's the slot version. Because I felt like in the Fantastic Four, there was moments where it was basically telling the story minus the dialogue. Whereas this is telling the story without the dialogue, without the need for it. The panel.
Well, before I even get into this issue, I would like to say that I think I did like the Fantastic Four issue better.
I did too.
I mean, I like this issue too, but I like this issue for like a different reason. I mean,
yeah, I was really torn. I didn't want to have to decide between the two of them. But I get definitely what JD is saying. Whereas, like, what it's true. Of the Fantastic, I mean, both of them have moments where clearly, like, what we're seeing is just something where nobody speaks, and we are not, it's not that we're seeing something that has had dialogue removed, it's that we are just looking at a moment that is genuinely silent. But in Fantastic Four, there are definitely moments where, there are moments where it is just genuinely silent, but then more so there are also scenes where it's clear that the dialogue is just not there, and that there is speech happening,
yeah. Yeah, actually, I want to put it this way. Of the two, I did like Fantastic Four better, and I'll explain why. Fantastic Four showed me something new and different, and sort of like something that superheroes do when one of their own falls, in a completely plausible and believable way. Amazing Spider-Man is something that I've personally gone through before, and I've seen it, and it's real. And you know, so it's something that happens. It's very true to life, and I think because all the, you know, Fantastic Four does something new and different that I've never seen before, I like it a little better. And that's no fault of you know Amazing Spider-Man. It's actually to its credit that it's that true to life. It's like wow, that's how it feels. Mm-hmm. That's like the emptiness, the loneliness, the solitude. But, I liked Fantastic Four just a little bit better. And I think it's because the whole issue worked better.
I think probably the art is better on Amazing Spidey.
Oh, I love the art in Fantastic Four.
I love the art in Fantastic Four.
Definitely, but I just Marcos Martin on Amazing Spidey. This is the first issue that Marcos Martin is. He's one of the three rotating guys. We got Humberto Ramos and Stefano Caselli.
Keep him. I love him.
Yeah, it's great.
the retro styling, especially as you get into the second half of story.
The second half lost me.
The second half is crazy, but if anything, I love how it starts. Want to show this image. Look at this. I don't know if you can see it very well.
That was nice. I like that.
You have to read it is you have to turn it and turn it and turn it until you get to the middle. Oh my God, it's great. Fantastic.
The best part of the issue, and I think the best part of the spoken part of the issue is when Marla was telling Peter that she would be back, and he was like, "It's like, well, yeah, I built Spider Slayers. I'm a villain. Villains always come back. You're not a villain. I guess I'm dead then."
I had deja vu about this because we were talking about Johnny dying and about how Johnny's coming back because he's a superhero, but Marla's not going to come back because she's just a backup character. Yeah. And when they said that, I was like, oh my God.
That was brilliant. That's brilliant. I mean, this issue is fantastic. You know, it's amazing, actually, I guess. But I like Fantastic Four a little better.
This issue is something of, I think Lott may have said it himself, it's something of a pocketed history of life and death in Spider-Man.
Only
the first 10 pages are the silent funeral. Yes. The rest of it is Spidey having a fever dream in which he relives and revisits and just meets everybody that basically, quite possibly, because Dan Slott did, oh crap, I just busted one of my staples. Everybody that he's ever known that's died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Crazy guilt-ridden dream about all these people that have died. And there's like some that I was like, who is this? I have no idea who this is.
What about the resolution?
I think I can name most of them.
What about the resolution? His realization at the end. What did you think about that?
I want to know where they're going with this. I want to see what happens next.
I hate to say this. Yes, Spider-Man, he says, from this point on, no one dies. On my watch, no one dies.
And then what happens on the next page?
Yeah, well, but that wasn't on his watch. But here's the thing. He's a superhero. He's supposed to save people. No one's supposed to die. Batman gets by with no one dying, and he doesn't have superpowers. Superman gets by with no one dying for the most part. It's great that Peter says, from this point on, no one dies, but that's just kind of your, job description. I don't really get that.
That's just setting up for Peter's about to have a bigger fall than he can ever imagine if he's thinking that I'm going to be able to stop this. I mean, I'm expecting bad stuff to be happening.
Yeah. This is fun. I think that's going to be really big shoes for Peter to try to fill. I mean, in a sense, that's one of the hallmarks of Spider-Man has been that he's been very real life. I mean, even think about just the things that has happened to him and the way that his life works. It's always that choice, that compromise, and never quite being able to be in all the places that he needs to be. I mean, that's a key component of the character. So I don't know. It's going to be a tough one.
And just like the end of the issue, just to kind of get this in, like I said, Peter says the whole line of whenever I'm around, no one dies. And then, like, the next page is, kablam, in big red letters. And we see a hostage situation, and somebody's been, looks like maybe shot in the head or something. He's, lying on the street. And then we've got this guy on the last page with this kind of, like, looks like he's got a metal plate in his head, this guy. And I don't know if that's somebody I should know who it is or a new character or what.
I looked at him and I thought he was supposed to be somebody pre-existing, but apparently it's a new character and Massacre is his name.
Yeah, I was expecting some sort of Dark Knight Returns, Spider-Man breaks through a wall and pulls him through sort of thing. No, the issue ended, so there you go.
Yeah. So, But yeah, good issue, great. I mean, has there been a bad issue of Amazing Spider-Man since Big Time started? Mm-hmm. If there has, I don't remember it.
No. I mean, there have been lull. I mean, there was like one or two issues there. It was kind of like, eh. But no, I mean, it's just, you know, slots.
Now, would you recommend this to someone? Would you recommend this to someone like me that hasn't read any Spider-Man? Would this be worth it for me to pick up?
Yeah, it would be a good place to start off, actually.
In some ways, this issue probably has more elements of what they were intending out of a point one, but good.
Oh, yeah, this should have been the point one.
This should have been the point one,
point one. Yeah, I mean, it's like, that's what you want out of the point one. Like, go back, tell the story, do something interesting, but yet you don't have to have read everything, you know, before and kind of give you a jumping on point. But no, it's so good. Like, it can't be a point one. It has to be.
Yeah.
You know, but that diminishes the... Well, we'll not get into a discussion about the point to point ones. Like, I mean, even though this is labeled part one of two, the only thing this makes this a part one is the last two pages setting up a cliffhanger. Otherwise, the issue is almost wholly self-contained. And it is a great, just... As I say, it's just a little run through life and death all across the history of Spider-Man. So, you know, for anybody who... knows what's going, you know, anybody who recognizes the references that are being made, like you're real, you know, a continuity nerd like me, this is great stuff as well. But you don't have to know and understand who these people are to get the intent of the emotion behind it. You know, it's very successful in just about every way, you know, artistically and just the intent, and it's got to be the best issue we've had yet. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very good.
Might awesome. Have to check it out.
Nicole, I guess then.
All right. Well, I got a lot of comics this week. I just haven't had time to read them yet. But I guess I'll start off with the one that I was totally confused by. It's called Murderland. I don't know if you guys can see that or not.
That's the best title ever. I've never read it, but I love the title. Yeah.
Okay, well, the thing is, since we're going with death, I'm like, okay, I'll review this. It's a death in a different way. The thing is, let me just give you a little warning. If you read comics at work, do not read this at work. There is a lot of violence and full frontal nudity in it, and so it's probably not the best when there's a lot of coworkers around. It's the first issue of a series. Of course, I'm a sucker for that. Try to figure it out. Basically, it's a bunch of assassins who are out to get one another, hence the name Murderland. The first assassin is more like a master of disguises, hence why she's running around naked a lot. So,
sounds like a good reason to me.
Good enough, so, anyway.
The thing is, she's totally bald, too, so I don't know if that... She's got the Sinead O'Connor look going on. Let's just say that. So,
hey, there's fans of that.
It works because she changes into wigs and stuff. And so basically it's assassin against assassin. This issue is kind of confusing at first because it's just setting up for the rest of the series. Again, there's a couple other... There's another little bitch fight in here. I don't know. Can I see that online? Sorry.
Fuck yes, so, you can.
But basically, that's all it is. It's a bunch of fighting. There's not really a whole lot of story until the last page where you see one person who is thought to be dead go to the cops and say, you need to go find this master of disguises. Like I said, it's kind of confusing. I don't know if I'd recommend it. Again, the title's really cool. The graphics are amazing. It's amazing artwork, but again, I found it confusing. I'll check out another one, but that's all I can say about that one. Like I said, not much goes on with that one.
Okay, nudity sounds good.
Basically full frontal nudity and a lot of violence. Like I said, do not read it at work. And the only other one that I could review that no one else has read, so I picked up the next Infestation Star Trek one.
Oh,
so this was the second one of it. Have you guys been reading the series, the Infestation?
No, I've been leafing through it, not reading it too closely.
Okay, I find this series so fun. I don't know if it's because I have a love for zombies or love for the main character Britt, who's, you know, zombie vampire. At first, I didn't like her, but I really came to like her in this one because she's just brutal. She does go after. Of course, you have Spock, Kurt, and the doc on the planet trying to save him. Basically, it ties nicely into the Transformers one because the computers are alive on this planet, and they've been infected as well with the virus, as they say. And so they found some surviving computers that tell them what's going on, and they kind of give them the cure to what's the infection. So good old Doc, he goes and saves everyone. But should I spoil it for you guys? Should I go ahead?
Sure.
Okay, yeah, so they do save people from the virus, but unfortunately, it cures their mind, but they still look like zombies.
Oh.
It cures their mind, but it doesn't cure them physically. So, and Britt is off to the next world, which is G.I. Joe next week. So, it's a fun series. I really recommend it. I probably will read this series even after the whole collage. So, if you're not reading it, do. It's really fun.
I've only read the Transformers ones personally, but I think
I like the trip. The Transformers one I thought was fun, too. You know what? I'm not a big Star Trek comic fan, and I had fun reading it. So,
There was just no getting around how awesome that scene from the first issue was, where Bones is scanning the guy and just turns over and goes, dead, Jim.
I love that.
You know what? He does have a lot of good one-liners in here, too. It's Bones just a fun comic. It's just fun. I do recommend it. So, and it does have that Star Trek feel, if you're a fan of Star Trek. So,
awesome.
Yeah, I recommend it.
Okay, so let's see. I am going to start with something that was recommended to me, which was The Mission. I'm not the only one that read this.
That was what I liked. It was
so, this is, to give a little backstory on this, this is by the Hober Brothers. I can't remember what it's called right now, but there's a move within some people at Image to try to get people who do film into comics, and these guys did the screen adaptation for Red.
I just saw that the other day.
And stuff. Yeah. So these guys wrote the screen adaptation for that, and then they're writing this four-part mini for Image Comics.
Actually, you know, I think that there should be an initiative to keep comic creators into comics.
Yes, instead of getting them into film. Yes.
Or, yeah, I don't really give a crap if someone who wrote a movie that I've never seen does a comic, and you know, unless it's good, and then, you know, they stay in comics. You know, I've never really cared for this whole, let's get famous Hollywood types into comics.
And it went so well with J. Michael Straczynski.
Bring back Brian K. Vaughan. Give him back
Thor
Hollywood.
Thor was good.
Okay, so this takes place in Chicago. Our main character starts out. I want to try to just give some details and not get too far into it. It's definitely a fish out of water story. I mean, we have our main character who starts out just, you know, basically coming back from a doctor's visit, and all of a sudden this old guy calling himself, I guess the guy's name, the main character is Paul Haskell, but this old man calling himself Gabriel, like, walks up to him in this dark parking garage and basically tells him that he's got to give him this mission and he's going to have to kill this guy, and gives him an envelope with the name and everything, and tells him he has 48 hours to kill the guy, or else, you know, or like his life depends on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he goes back, and, you know, he has basically a fairly, you know, average life, wife, kids, job, that sort of deal. And he basically blows the guy off and comes back the next day and runs into Gabriel again. And he's basically like, you know, you can't escape this. You know, your life depends on it. And at the same time, he gets a phone call from the doctor saying, hey, some of your tests came back weird. And Gabriel mentioned something about, you know, cancer is a real bitch or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the implication being,
well, the thing is, he told him that before his doctor told him.
Yes, exactly. Like, the doctor didn't say anything, but he's implying that he knew. Yeah.
So there's definitely an element that the guy, there's other things going on. So he gives him the envelope again and tells him he has, you know, 27 hours left. So obviously the guy kind of pours over the information, considers it a little bit more, especially after a fairly horrific dream where he's apparently burning in hell.
But if you notice, he has also the seven deadly sins written on blood on him.
All carved into his flesh, yes.
I was going to ask if there was any kind of biblical significance behind
the guy's
name.
Oh, yeah, it's the angel. It is the angel Gabriel.
Biblical? Yeah, what about Captain Marvel?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, like, even on the front, it has the Jewish word for God on there. It also has the archangels in the doors.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's like a seal thing on the cover. Mm-hmm. And Gabriel has these big black wings, actually, on the cover as well. Mm-hmm. So he decides to track this guy, and of course, like, the first thing the guy does is goes to a playground, but he's, like, picking up his daughter from school, and then the guy goes to church, and even when Paul, like, tracks him into the church, one of the priests, you know, stops him and says something about, you know, I don't know, finding God or something, coming to the church, whatever. So he gets his... Like, Gabriel runs into him again and hands him a newspaper with a knife in it and basically is like, you know, this is it, this is your last chance. And he couldn't pull the trigger. He couldn't kill the guy. So follows him again, and the guy goes into the courtroom, and apparently he's in, like, a custody hearing. And apparently he loses because the guy pulls out a gun and starts gunning people down.
What kind of security's at this courtroom?
Yeah. But whatever. But never mind that. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, just starts, I mean, kills all these people and even points the gun at Paul and just tells him to take it easy and walks out. So, wow.
Well, you know? the whole purpose is he realizes what's going to be happening here at the end. And so he knows he's screwed up. He knows he was supposed to do something.
Yeah, if he would have off the guy like he was told to,
He could none of this would have happened. Now he's probably going to feel the guilt.
Yeah, it has like a very, it has like if, it has that feel of like the Dead Zone, where it's like, but it's without the intuition piece, but it's like very similar. It's like, and it's failed. It's like the Dead Zone with the ending where he doesn't die, but he's failed. You know what I mean? So it's kind of it's interesting. I'd be interested to see where.
So it's like the Dead Zone TV show.
I guess so.
I don't know.
But the art style is pretty. I mean, it's really heavy lines. It's really interesting as far as that goes. It's not. I mean, I don't. It's not great.
Who is the artist?
Deladera, I guess.
Werther Deladera, yeah.
So. Yeah, Werther Deladera.
Is this a short or a mini series?
No, this is a 4-part mini.
Oh.
So there'll be another next month. I don't know. I may check it out. I may not. Just to see if this. Yeah, this was Caldera, sublined with Caldera, and that's the one that's trying to bring in. Writers.
Well, if I'm being honest now, I was intrigued by the sound of that from the start. It sounded very, very Twilight Zone-y, just the idea of guy walks up to you, charges you the mission. But then as soon as we hit the biblical stuff, I'm like, maybe not then. You know, I gotta say, it sounded more interesting without that in it.
See, I'm also a person, I love studying about religion, so this is kind of like on my terms. So it's,
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, the twist at the ending was really interesting, but I'm not real, it's almost like I wanted it to not take that, or not do that yet, so that I would, but I don't know. I don't know if it doesn't grab me like I really feel like I want to grab the next issue. I sort of feel like, oh, well, that was interesting, and I'm good, you know? So I don't know. But, I mean, like I said, a good enough story in and of itself. I could tell it definitely had, like, a Hollywood pacing almost to it, though, as far as, like,
I was the bad guy, I was trying to figure out if they rearranged the letters to make another words and stuff. He's trying to do that with his name. Yeah, he's trying to figure out if his name meant something. Neil Corman.
I didn't care that much.
hey, Triplett.
Yeah.
Del Rusk.
Del Rusk was awesome. Oh, I miss Geoff Johns at Avengers.
Ah,
that
the classics.
So epic.
For those who don't know what we're talking about, go and read Red Zone by Geoff Johns.
It's very good.
So anyway, so that's the mission. I don't know. Maybe check it out.
Think I'll not.
Yeah, I think I felt
if good. I'm honest.
So. But yet again, death. Yes, hello. And speaking of death, my love, my current love, next to Booster Gold, Jen lost. So, last issue, you may remember, Jaime got shot in the head.
How's that going for
him? Well, I'll tell you. I'll tell you. This issue is, I don't know, this issue feels like a not Geoff Johns version of Secret Origins Max Lord. It feels, I don't know a lot about Max's history, but most of this issue is retelling key points of his history that may not have been told. So the first bit of the story is like he's in high school and he comes home and his father has shot himself in the head. And apparently his father worked for like a big chemical corporation or something, and he found out that they were hiding like negative results of some tests and things. And he was going to report them, and they basically made his death look like a suicide. And so he knew, you know, of course, Max knew and his mother knew. And like from there, that's what got Max into like building up a corporate empire and trying to take them down and take them over. And he actually ended up failing at that because Lex beat him to taking over the company, which was Chemtech. And so there's a lot of exchanges in this issue that happened between Max and his mother talking about his motivation to succeed, and yet she's trying to remind him, you know, to remember where he came from, but yet to be powerful. There's a really great point later once he got his mind control abilities in which she talks to him and basically tells him, you know, yes, now you have powers like them, but you're not one of them. And never forget that. Never forget that no matter what happens, you're not one of them. You're one of us. And so you start to see where Max came from. I mean, as far as like his motivation of trying to control those with superpowers. The whole reason that he did the JLI, in a sense, was to have control over his own group of superheroes. And what his mother basically said was, you know, he has the power now to control minds, but he's always had that ability. It's just that it's a little bit easier for him once he actually gets his powers. So it's not really something new for him to deal with. It's just that it makes it easier for him to do that. And then I think the most revealing part, which I think this is new and a bit of a retcon. There's a moment where Max is sort of watching all the news screens after Coast City was destroyed, and he's drinking and obviously he's probably had a little bit too much to drink, and Booster comes in, basically saying that he's, you know, there to help, or they're going to, you know, go to work on stuff. And he starts talking to Max, and Max has this dialogue with him where he basically says, you know, this is all your fault, meaning the superhero community. And he's like, you know, saying that essentially if it wasn't for them, would all these people have died? You know, that it's because of the superheroes that the supervillains do what they do. And it's that escalation of power argument that, you know, if it just wasn't for the superpowered heroes, there wouldn't be superpowered villains, and, you know, things like Coast City wouldn't have happened. And he even said, you know, there was like a difference between things like Doomsday, who was basically just sort of a force of nature, and then superheroes came in and stopped, and yeah, people died, but that was just sort of a force of nature thing. This is just a villain being a villain. as far as what happened to Coast City, and it was sort of pointless and meaningless. And Booster kind of, you know, he gets the idea that there's more going on, and Max says that his mother lived in Coast City. So essentially his mother was killed during the destruction of Coast City. And at the end of that conversation, you know, Booster starts to kind of apologize, and Max tells him to forget that he ever knew that. And it was that bit that started Max down the line of, you know, the OMAX and all of the other events that took place, because essentially it's from that base motivation that essentially it's the heroes that are causing the villains to do terrible things, and he's trying to prevent that escalation and all of those things from happening. So I think it gives Max...
So Max became an asshole during the reign of the Superman, is what you're saying?
Who did?
No, he's always been an asshole.
He's always been an asshole.
That's the thing, and I think that's what's interesting too, is it goes back, is he's always been an asshole because he was made bitter by the death of his father, because his father's death was, you know, covered up and made to look like a suicide. That is what was his base motivation for becoming rich, for becoming powerful, and then, you know, his motivation going forward. So, and then it's just that after his mother was killed as well, that just put him over essentially that edge where essentially, you know, now he really does blame the heroes community for the death of his mother, because it's essentially them that caused the destruction of Coast City and everything else. So,
this is a pretty solid comic overall, you know, but I have to admit that I have a lot of trouble seeing it as anything other than the next in a line of what is already several attempts at retroactive justification for a casual massive alteration to Max's character. I have no prior history with Max Lord prior to Infinite Crisis because I didn't read DC. I didn't know the guy. Meant
wow.
Nothing to
me before that, he was a used car salesman of a character. Imagine.
I was aware of that because of all the rage that sprung up after he shot Ted Ford. But, you know, so it doesn't mean much to me personally, but it's like it always just seems very apparent to me that the villainizing of Max was never very well thought out. So it seems to just always be one explanation on top of another. You know, as I understand it, before Infinite Crisis, when Max had last appeared, he was a cyborg. Excuse me. Yeah, and there was no explanation for why he was human again with mind control powers now suddenly whenever Infinite Crisis started. So they had to slip these little casual. I think it was an early issue of Booster Gold maybe, where Max commented in a narration box about how he'd spent millions on surgeries to get himself turned back to normal. So, you know, over a year later, before they tried to casually, quickly explain something like that away.
That's awesome.
Yeah, even in this issue, he mentioned something about an alien invasion.
I think that's the Bloodlines.
Oh.
Because Bloodlines was the one that, what is it, the aliens drank people's spines? Or something. them doing... What was that? 1993, I think. And them doing that gave some people powers. That's where Hitman came from. Hitman being the only character anybody remembers coming
out.
Was
that Garth Ennis that did Hitman?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so.
And I guess they're retroactively explaining that that's the source of Max's mind control powers, not his Bloodlines.
Yeah, I think so. So,
not that I have anything against retcons or anything like that, and particularly, I mean, these mean nothing to me on a personal level, but it's just kind of poor Max. They just really have to keep trying to make
it right for him. Well, because it's hard to explain why a character who had been, I mean, even though he may have been sort of a used car salesman, he was still sort of a hero character. And I think that without a good arc in there, it's hard to explain why a good character goes bad like that all of a sudden.
Is it wrong of me to just want him to go with Booster Gold and Blue Beetle, have a beer, and maybe set some guy's foot on fire or something and laugh at him?
Yeah.
Well,
because I kind of want that Max bag is what I want.
You're,
I don't know.
You're right at the end of the Giffen to Mateus run, so so you've got two issues of that left-ish.
Oh, awesome. I should read that.
But anyway, so into this, so you see, so at the end of this, Max launches the new, checkmate building slash spaceship thing, and all of our JLI heroes escape with Blue Beetle, and Rocket's Red, hooks up all his tech equipment to it, and they're, you know, asking how Jaime is and what's going on, and he just looks down and looks back up, and he's dead.
Aww.
Shocking.
I can't help but read that. It's Skeets who says that line, isn't it?
No.
Isn't it Skeets?
It's Rocket's Red.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's Rocket's Red, because he's got his equipment hooked up to Jaime's suit, so he's apparently getting the readings out of his suit. But he says he's dead. I don't know.
So getting shot in the head, last issue. Wait until now to announce that he's dead. We'll notice the scarab hasn't actually retracted itself from his body.
That is exactly. I would think that the scarab would retract if he was dead.
Well, can the scarab take control of his body and he become a zombie Blue Beetle now or something?
Ooh, that's the next big title from DC.
Yeah.
Zombie Blue Beetle.
Blue Beetle.
There it is, Ed and Black.
I'd read it. I'm a sucker for zombies.
I like this issue for the Max Lord stuff, and I do kind of feel like, one issue worth of Jaime's dead, okay, he's not really, is okay with me. Two issues, if he's not really dead, I'm going to be really disappointed, because it's not really fair. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you do it once and it's sort of a bait and switch and then he's okay, that's fine. But to do that twice, I think, is a bit excessive.
And I can't believe he's dead. DC loves that character too much.
No, I mean, he's going to be in Smallville in, a month?
Yeah, sometime in March, I think.
You know.
The
world doesn't love him enough in order for him to keep an ongoing series, but DC editorial really loves him. It's like Marvel and Moon Knight.
Yeah. But the other thing is I don't know what's left for the character to do. Gen Lost is going to end with the end of Brightest Day. They've got Booster moving into Flashpoint. I don't know. Maybe they are going
to
kill that character.
Find something for him to do. Go off, join the Teen Titans or something.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe could do something for him to do. Yeah. Moon Knight's Secret Avengers.
Yeah.
Touche. So, anyway,
Daredevil just so they could keep publishing Black Panther. Some editorial groups will not let certain things that the rest of the world has made clear they don't care about go.
Yeah, so we'll see. I don't know. Hey, I like the Matt stuff. Go ahead.
Have they announced if there's a trade of this going to be coming out soon?
Oh, I assume there will be. I don't know if
the first hardcover volume has been solicited, but it's DC, so that probably means it's still not due until May or something, but it has been solicited. I think it contains... I want to say this one, with Brightest Day, they're doing 3 8-issue volumes. I want to say with this one, they're doing 2 12-issue volumes, so I think the first 12-issue trade hardcover, or is it a hardcover? Well, collection, anyway, has been solicited. I just looked that up. Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah. Anyway, like I said, I like the Max stuff, but we'll see what happens with Beetle. So, anyway, all right, McFeely, there you go, sir. Take it away.
Well, yeah, I've just done that in a timely fashion in order to confirm that the Generation Lost hardcover is out on the second week of April, collecting the first 12 issues. So there you go.
Thank you.
No problem. That's my job.
Anytime I have a question, I'll just ask you.
There you go.
What everyone else does. What did I read this week? I read a bunch of stuff this week, but there's so little to say about a lot of it. I read Avengers number 10, and it is the Avengers hopscotch around the world and chat.
Oh yeah.
The more interesting thing about this issue is the fact that they've reprinted the entirety of Heroes for Hire issue 1 as a backup strip. And that's great. That's a great way of doing things. Do it in the old 1970s DC style-y, where they included a free comic in there to try and raise the profile of stuff. So that's good. I also read Ultimate Spider-Man And they sure did fight over the Scorpio key in there. That was it. You know, that was about it. Yeah. Much happened. And I read Thor this week as well, which was 4 minutes well spent, you know.
I liked it. I liked it a lot, actually.
Truly, truly gorgeous artwork. I'm loving the art on this. But this issue is a cover-to-cover fight in which Odin merges all of the bodies and consciousnesses of the Asgardian gods through a blood rite into a trio of blood colossus, which just rip their way through the world eaters. And it's certainly very pretty and very action packed and pounding. You know, it's a great fight, but that's all there is to it. I mean, yeah. You know, if I'm completely frank, it's a rarity, but the two comics that I read this week, outside of the death issues that we have talked about and that I will talk about in a second, the ones that had the most meat on their bones were actually Transformers Rising Storm and Transformers Foundation, the two new movie prequels that came out this week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're written by quality. You know, I'll be talking about those at more length over on the Underbase podcast next week, but they are very dense. They're written by John Barber, who wrote the Sector 7 prequel miniseries, who is a maestro of movie continuity and has proven his ability to write robots as well as he wrote humans in that series, establishing a lot of personality for characters who haven't had any before in a very short space of time, performing some very crafty and good retcons, and at the same time playing very much and very well in an established sandbox where he works around and through and uses everything that's come before to tell three very solid stories that have a lot of talking points about them. They're some of the best Transformers comics that have come out this year so far. And I look forward to more of them. And I would sit here and talk more about those if I wasn't going to talk about them on another podcast for two hours.
I enjoyed them. You know, I was always iffy with movie stuff. Mm. But yeah,
there have been more bad movie comics than good ones at this point. You know,
I preferred Reign of Starscream. That's still my favorite movie comic. But you know, this is only one issue so far. So
I just think John Barber has very quickly established himself as the go-to guy.
You know what? And it seems to be there's some what's that word continuity?
It's steeped in it.
Yeah. Can you imagine that? It's actually worth
continuity? In Transformers?
Yeah, in Transformers. Can you believe it? Yeah.
Really? Oh, my God.
Yeah, he's done some very good stuff with Alita 1. And what's also really good is that they're not just the first issue of two separate miniseries. These are very much two things that are supposed to be concurrently published and read. You know, there's themes evident in and references to things that are happening in one book that are in another.
I love Shockwave on the cover there. He looks beautiful. Yes.
And Shockwave is in it. You have that going for it. It's got that going for it as well. I would say of the two, Foundation is probably the better, but I felt that I got more talking points, more interesting continuity work, and just general setup in Rising Storm. I'm hard pushed.
See, Rising Storm better. I liked Rising Storm a little bit better.
If I sat and thought about it, I'd probably lean over to Rising Storm. I'm very much on the edge. It's just both of them do Rising Storm probably accomplishes more, but Foundation does some interesting world building. See, Foundation has the rather unenviable position of that it has to fill in a load of backstory that is necessary for the story of the third movie that's coming up without making it contradict the two previous movie prequels already had. It's really got a little bit of dancing through hoops in there, but he has managed it very well so far. Mm-hmm. Despite a panicky thread on 2005 that ran around screaming that it was all about contradictions and it totally threw it out and Defiance wasn't in continuity anymore, that's wrong, and it is, and he's done very good so far. But Rising Storm, versus Alliance, last year's between movie prequel, stuff happens in this one, so that's an immediate of Alliance.
I actually look forward to the next one. Unlike the ongoing, you know.
Well, ongoing is, yeah, that's why we don't talk about that on the show for a reason. Comics, and I can easily say more about them than anything else I read this week. So there you go. That's why I'm talking about them for a little bit. Right. Well then, with that out of the way, we'll conclude with the other death issue this week, and it's got to be me that does this, doesn't it?
It has to.
Yep. Last month in Fantastic Four, the Human Torch met his end. And this month is the
spoiler.
Final.
Jeez. Yeah. How dare you ruin it?
Wow. Threw it out there.
This month is the final issue of Fantastic Four, and it presents us with a double-sized issue with two stories, both written by Jonathan Hickman. The first one entitled A Month of Mourning, which is the longer of the two, and it is an entirely silent story with art by Nick Dragata. And a backup strip, which is what the preview pages that were shown for this issue online, the discussion between Spider-Man and Franklin Richards, with art by Mark Brooks. And, Brian, well, you say what you said. I think that just summed this issue up very well before we go anywhere. Say what you said about these two.
Oh, about the two books?
Versus Spider-Man, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so Fantastic Four treats, shows what happens when superheroes die and how they deal with it. Amazing Spider-Man shows basically what happens when, you know, humans suffer death and a loss. And I mean, Amazing Spider-Man is very true to life, at least the first half of it, you know. But Fantastic Four, it shows something sort of new and crazy and different. It's why these people can, you know, blow up cities with the flick of a wrist, you know. So what happens when, you know, when one of them fall? How do they feel? How do they react?
This story, it covers the span of a whole month. The story, the issue is called A Month of Mourning. It doesn't literally cover every day, but it does jump from day to day, and those are the only words for throughout the strip. Just little captions that say day number whatever. The Invisible Woman returns to the Baxter Building to find the Human Torch has died. She is just inconsolable. Reed Richards opens the Negative Zone portal and threatens Annihilus with the ultimate nullifier.
That was so awesome.
That was awesome. I love that.
Only to have him hold up the tattered remains of the Human Torch's costume and laugh in his face.
God, I love that.
Cruel
so
stuff. Cruel. And even the echoes are even felt in Latveria, where Christoph Vernard, Doom's protege, is following on from a brief mention of it we had earlier in the series. He is now appointed ruler in Doom's stead while Doom tries to recover his lost intelligence. His appearance, even following off the back of Christoph's recent appearance in Christos Gage's Fantastic Four and Spider-Man miniseries that I talked about on the show when it was coming out. Doom attends the funeral without incident.
Which is plausible and believable.
Utterly and completely. There, you know, I could just run through all of the moments in this, you know, and there are a lot of them, but there are some fantastic moments. I mean, Hickman is just, I can't say scripted, but, you know, laid out a wonderful... I mean, I think there's an image of the Invisible Woman on day three. She's just curled up in a ball on her bed, silently staring off this wonderful, dark, heavy inked image. And Reed reaches out to try and put his hand on her shoulder, but he can't because she's surrounded herself with an invisible force field, and all he can do is fingers just stretch around it. He can't touch her. She's just so shut off. It's a wholly visual thing that words are not needed for. Similarly, there's the very first scene where the Avengers break into the Baxter Building and they find the Thing embracing Franklin and Valeria. And Valeria, you know, the Thing is destroyed. His eyes are red from weeping as he looks up. You know, this is the Thing in, like, his most vulnerable, I think, he's ever been seen. And Valeria looks around at the arrival of the Avengers. And what the fuck is that little mutant bitch even thinking? You can't read her expression. There's nothing. You're not even crying, you little freak. What is wrong with you? You know, that's we know. They haven't really touched on it, because a lot of what they've done with Valeria has just been with her intelligence, because obviously Mark Miller created the concept of the super intelligent Valeria, and Mark Miller is an ideas man. Mark Miller said, "Oh yeah, what if Valeria was super intelligent? She could say really long, funny sentences. You know, there's no exploration of the ideas behind that. So then, you know, it really starts to become aware that what we have here is a child who has immense intelligence, like her father." But as much as Reed doesn't have much in the way of people skills, Valeria doesn't have any of the emotional maturity to funnel her intelligence. It's almost like she doesn't even really seem to know how to react to the Human Torch's death. The first thing she does, there's this wonderful scene on day 20, she starts listing up potential replacements for the Human Torch on the blackboard of the Future Foundation. But then she wubs them all out.
God, I love
and instead
this.
She replaces yeah. it with this. Kill Annihilus. But I look at that and I wonder, has Valeria written this because this is what she wants to do? Or has Valeria written this because she thinks this is what everyone else wants to do? I can't read this little psycho.
Sort of like sociopathic tendencies yeah. almost. Yeah.
Is she like, oh, well, nobody is reacting to this list I have written up on the blackboard. What will I replace it with? I don't know how to... We've already seen the complete sociopathic tendencies she has. Yeah. She went off to make a deal with Dr. Doom upon learning that her dad didn't accept the council's stance that he would have to give up his family to join with them. It is... You know, just in two, and that's an intensely creepy moment on so many different levels. Because ultimately, if these kids want to do that, they are going to find a way to do it.
Oh yeah,
and then on a whole other level, we've got the thing goes out into the desert on day 26 and meets Bruce Banner and Donald Blake, who I think they're just trying to present him with a little holographic memorial of the torch is all they're trying to do. But the thing just won't have it. He shrugs them off. And, of course, the thing deals with this in the only way that he can. Bruce and Don turn into Thor and the Hulk, and they just have a fight. You know, the thing just... I mean, this is just fantastic six-panel piece of artwork as the thing just pounds and pounds and pounds away on the Hulk until all he's doing is just beating his fists against his chest and just collapses in tears against him. It's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, had a lesser writer done this, Ben would have probably ended up fighting the Hulk and beating him, which is preposterous. So
in his rage.
Yeah.
And then the strip just concludes with Reed, days without sleep, eyes red, sitting in his lab, unshaven, staring at his threat board, the Negative Zone invasion, Inhumans invasion, in Celestial invasion, Franklin's powers, Galactus on the way, and the reformation of the council necessary. And then the final page of the first strip, his portal activates and Nathaniel, his father, steps out of the time stream, and the only words in the issue, "Hello, son, I'm home."
Awesome.
Nathaniel last seen being kicked into the time stream by Franklin at the end of that earlier story.
And, that sounds like a good story. Man,
it is so good.
My favorite part's the back. This is the second strip, actually.
That's it. I mean, ultimately,
that part's really good.
I think the art in the second strip probably succeeds in selling a lot of what's in it a little better than Dragotta's art does on this first.
It's so Jack. You know, the first strip is so Jack Kirby. Forcibly Jack Kirby, but I still liked it a lot.
Oh yes, absolutely. But sometimes you just can't. There's just not as much emotion there, you know. Like the Invisible Woman's face as Franklin Hoaxster, you know, I don't know what she's feeling there, you know. The funny thing is, this backup strip is about, there's not much point in me going doing a read through of it or anything. It is Spider-Man and Franklin talk about Johnny's death, and Ben tells him about, Spidey tells him about the time his uncle died. And Franklin's fears that he could have used his powers to stop his uncle from dying, and how Spider-Man knows he could have used his powers to save his uncle.
It's
great. You know, I got a little quaver in my throat when I was reading it. You know, but it's drawn by Mark Brooks, who historically I have not been a huge fan of. When I first saw him on the Ultimate Spider-Man title, I always thought he was overly cartoony and chunky and not in a not in a natural sort of way. It didn't feel like it was natural. But I didn't recognize him when I first read. I got to the last page and I was like, "Shit, that was Mark Brooks! Fuck, awesome."
I've read his novels more than I have his comic book works.
I wonder if it's the same Mark Brooks. I'm honestly not even sure.
Is it the one that wrote World War Z?
That's Max Brooks.
Oh, that's Max Brooks. Okay, that's
okay. Mel Brooks' son.
So this is a much more. The backup strip is a much more intimate moment. The main strip is an overview full of like isolated moments, which just like have a lot of punch that sink in emotionally. Some of them setting up seeds for the future. Some of you just allowing you to see the characters at their most emotionally naked. But the backup strip is a lot more of an intimate conversation between two people actually sharing some very natural and real thoughts. I mean, there's some. I'm very. Where is that one line? What is it? So Franklin just says, "Uncle Johnny died," and Spidey says, "I know. I'm very sorry about that. So, how are you doing with all that?" And Franklin replies, "I get a little chill of it. I can't sleep. I keep having bad thoughts." And I'm like, you don't even need to say any more than that. Everybody knows the bad thoughts. Yeah. There is a simplistic, intimate beauty in that. And it's just, you know, it's just like, as an intimate like discussion of death between two characters, the second strip is definitely like the superior of the first. But there's a lot of quality material in the first strip as well. It's this issue was $4. Fantastic Four has been $3. This issue is $4, but it is a double sized issue. It's got like 32 pages of story in there, whatever. So you're getting what you pay for. Frankly, you know, I mean, if I got quality like this, every $4 book that I bought, I wouldn't be complaining about any rises in price.
Right.
And it concludes
the only thing I said like about the silent bit is there's a couple of bits in here where it does seem like there could have been dialogue, but it was cut out, as opposed to, like I said, out of like the Spider-Man issue where no dialogue was necessary. So, like, the Reed and Annihilus bit, like, that, it's like there could have been dialogue there, and that was cut. Even the bit with
I feel like
Thing and the Hulk and Thor, it seems like there
that really
could have been
feels
dialogue
like,
there.
Yeah,
I doubt, I would think that Hickman from the beginning intended for this to be a
it's a silent representation of a scene where characters probably are talking. It's just that the dialogue isn't there, you know.
I take that to be most of the scenes. I mean, sure, silent issues, but I think any one of the scenes probably included dialogue that we weren't privy to.
The scene of Reed and Sue, for instance.
There's no dialogue that's even necessary there.
No, but I mean, you know, there's no.
Or the funeral.
The funeral.
Stuff like that. But, you know, a lot of the other scenes feel like, you know, somebody was probably saying that. But, you know, as you say, compared to Spidey, the moments captured in the Spider-Man story. Because it does sort of jump from moment to moment, the Spider-Man story, but in a much sort of smaller time frame than this month-spanning story. It stops and picks out the moments in that small space of time where people wouldn't be speaking, you know, whereas this one just is a little less... The silence flows a little less naturally than it did with Spider-Man, put it that way.
I kind of felt when I was reading it... And there's even the scene in the silent part where Spidey swings up to Franklin, and I kind of felt like, I mean, even though that is a backup story, I kind of felt like that, oh, this is what happens right after, like, Nathan shows up. I mean, it just kind of seamlessly just, like, turn the page, oh, now they're having a conversation. This is where the words come in when I was reading it. And then I noticed, oh, this is considered a different story. Okay.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And then the whole thing ends with like a short letter from Jonathan Hickman to readers, you know, and it just ends with this is the last issue of Fantastic Four. Where exactly do we go from here? Well, pretty simple, really. Same place we've been headed the entire time. Tomorrow.
Awesome.
Very awesome. And yes, standing orders at my store for Fantastic Four have doubled the past week with people wanting to get in for FF, so
Awesome.
Nice.
Times are good. Excellent comic of an excellent series. I think I'm going to do some kind of sparring edition. It's just going to be a bit of like a little retrospective of all of Hickman's run up so far.
And I can't wait till Fantastic Four 600.
Yeah.
Yeah. That. So awesome.
Yeah.
What is that, next year?
Like 1 year from now. It'll be FF12.
Yeah, like FF12.
With a little 600 underneath it.
Or they'll swap or something.
Yeah, or they'll swap.
The turn of Johnny Storm.
And yeah, I was thinking, though, I was constantly saying that I figured Batman would be back for his 700 issue, though, but he wasn't.
No.
Yeah. It just... Well, but let's think back, though. I mean, that was Grant Morrison... And Grant Morrison does stuff on his own timeline. So, you know. Well. They were like, you know what would be great, Grant, is if you could have him back for the 700. And Grant's like, yeah, that would be great, wouldn't it? Anyway. I'm going to be...
Speaking of Grant Morrison.
Speaking of Grant Morrison. So, top of the show, here we are. It is time for All-Star Superman, which was the DC Universe animated film. Came out on my birthday on Tuesday.
Happy birthday. That's a good present.
Happy birthday.
Yes, for my birthday, I got an awesome comic book writer dying and All-Star Superman. Yay me. I'll let someone that's more invested in this talk about this. Who wants to talk about this? Brian, do you want to talk about
You have no heart, JD. Happy birthday.
Yeah.
I think your apathy towards this just proves that you are completely biased against Superman.
Yeah, you got something against Superman. That's what it is.
I gotta go on JD's side with this. You're not alone, buddy.
Okay. Maybe some people are biased in favor of Superman.
Mm. No. I've read all kinds of Superman crap, and I've quit buying Superman. I can't tell you how many times. All-Star Superman is just – I mean, the Grant Morrison comic is just – it's probably the best superhero story of the last generation or two. It's just – it takes everything that's awesome about Silver Age Superman and just puts it in a modern context. Great, great stuff. The movie All-Star Superman, Dwayne McDuffie's script, is pitch perfect to the tone of the... it doesn't follow the exact continuity and things. It's very faithful, but there are some changes in the transition. But it's pitch perfect. It feels like you're watching the comic. McFeely, I mean, what did you think?
Well, I definitely say I really enjoyed it. I definitely think it's one of the best ones they've put out, one of the best animated movies. A lot of people throw around that best superhero story thing. You know, I can never entirely get behind that definition for All-Star Superman. People who love comics... And I have any kind of nostalgia for that era of Superman, which Grant Morrison has coming out his ears,
yes,
which is the reason why this is the way it is. I don't think that I could ever hold this up to somebody who wants to be told why Superman is awesome. I hear that as a definition as well. If you want to know why Superman is awesome, read All-Star Superman. I can't get behind that because All-Star Superman is a strange 50-year-old idealized version of Superman that is not relevant to Superman as the media today perceives
it. That's very true.
So the film has that working against it from a modern media standpoint. The thing about the film is that it makes absolutely no illusions to trying to reshape the vision of Superman that the comic book has. It does present this the old idea, it's not something you see, it's just not in comics anymore, but it was a big thing in the Silver Age, was that Superman was super at everything, including smarts. You know, he was a super genius as well. So that is reflected in this. And even in other Grant Morrison works like Final Crisis, where Superman builds a machine after looking at it once, you know, stuff like that. This is the super genius Superman who builds suns on a cosmic anvil and
things
like
that. That's awesome.
I love that.
It's totally awesome. It's a fantastic
It's so Greek.
Like,
He's a god.
That is true. That is truly what it is. It is. It is. It is mythical. And this is like Superman the myth. It's an almost unclassifiable fusion of Superman the myth and Superman the man. It's hugely grand and cosmic and uncontainable in its scope and its subject matter, but it's also very, very understated in the little moments.
Yes.
As a film, I mean, the hook of this, like, just for anybody that hasn't watched it and has no plans to, the idea is that Lex Luthor sabotages the first manned mission to the sun, prompting Superman to stage a rescue, but in the process receive a lethal exposure of solar radiation that overcharges his cells and eventually leads to cellular breakdown that will eventually kill him. So he decides to... The movie is Superman's bucket list, ticking off the great things that he's always wanted to do or never been able to do in his life before he finally dies. And that is sort of where I feel the animated adaptation of the comic falls down a bit, because it's very Herculean, 12 labors.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
There's an idea that he performs task after task.
It has 12.
Well, the comic, yeah, there's 12 issues, 12 tasks. But the comic has 12 issues to do this in, but this has 75 minutes. So that aspect of the film is really lost. But, well, I can't blame...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get that out of the film.
Mm-hmm. No. I can't blame the film, really, because this is a Grant Morrison story, so it is a comic. That's what Grant Morrison has written, a story that is nothing that is at its zenith. Like, it is a serial story told through comic, and nothing that you could translate into other media and preserve the entirety of. If they could have done a 3-hour film and done all of the labors from the comic, then maybe not 3 hours, but you know what I mean. The idea would have worked because you could have actually studied the labors. But ultimately, by cutting out what labors were, you know, it's like Superman finds out he's dying.
Yeah.
Superman gives Lois Lane the superpowers, and on their adventure together, they meet Samson and Atlas, time travelers, who tell Superman that before he dies, he will perform the greatest...
But let me interrupt there. That sounds really awesome so far. And you're not even done yet. That's not even all of them yet.
Well, they tell him that he will perform the greatest feats of his career before his death. And then in the comic, he goes on to do loads of things. He saves the Bizarro world. He creates life. He cures cancer.
He creates us.
Yeah, he creates our world. But in the film, he does one more thing.
Yeah.
None of the actual... It becomes more of an anthology of interest than it does... Superman, the 12 labors of Superman, purely because of the need to condense it down. There are lots of issues from the story of Clark seeing Luthor in prison, that's an issue of the comic. The Kryptonian astronauts, that's an issue of the comic. The final battle with Luthor is 2 issues of the comic, but it's all those other... But the movie only takes what it absolutely has to make the story work from start to finish. This film has a start, and it has an end. And it has just a bunch of vignettes in the middle. And it's more of an anthology of interest than it is, you know, you've watched it, you can't unwatch it.
Well, and that's, like, I think, why for someone like me who I haven't read All-Star Superman, maybe didn't get as invested in it. Because I think if you've seen it, you know all the stuff in the middle. And then you can say, wow, this was a great visual representation of it. But I don't have that investment as far as I haven't read it. Now, I'll have to admit, what you're talking about sounds interesting. I like that concept of, you know, connecting him to, you know, ancient mythology, and I think I could probably get into it if I read it. But the film doesn't necessarily bring that across.
Well, it's not trying to. That's the thing. It's adapting the general story. It's adapting the feel. It's adapting the wonder. It's adapting the that that nostalgia for Superman, the Silver Age Superman that everyone, you know, knew and loved, that's imbued throughout the whole All-Star Superman comic. It's putting that into film. It's not trying to, you know, capture every single detail from the 12-issue run. It can't.
But if you're not invested in the character in that way, like if you're not invested in that Silver Age version of the character, that doesn't come across.
I think I know where JD's coming from, because I didn't read the comic books and I watched this and I was like confused. I'm like, okay, so that was the end of that story. Are we onto something new? I didn't know where the exact ending to one storyline was and the beginning of another. It just felt way too mumbled jumbled. I was confused.
By and large, I think that the film works. I think it's that Kryptonian astronauts bit that disrupts the film.
Yeah.
Because everything else that happens is connected except for that bit, which just drops in the middle there and interrupts the flow of the core story and everything that's going on.
Take that out and add a short, and I think it would have been perfect.
Some kind of montage, even, just of Superman doing things. To actively just select that one story. There's a story where Jimmy Olsen takes over Cadmus and turns into Doomsday. There's at least two issues which are dedicated to... I should actually probably notice I haven't read the comic properly cover to cover, so this is all just cursory knowledge, in which Superman saves the Bizarro world, and we meet Zibarro, the Bizarro.
Zibarro's awesome!
He's the Bizarro Bizarro who is the right way round and writes poetry and stuff. I can't quite fathom why they elected to just take this one story. I'm not sure. It may just be that I'm not getting it, but I'm not sure what the Kryptonian astronaut story
could be
represents.
It's similar-ish, not really, kind of, but we've had the new Krypton storyline in Superman for the last couple of years.
I don't think so.
Eh. Well, and it also harkens back to...
1982 Superman 2.
Yeah, so... But... And that's where I say, like, there were bits that I liked, and I don't want to say that, like, I didn't like it as a whole. I mean, it was certainly watchable and at least followable, but I didn't feel like really, really invested in it. But there were moments, like the key thing, that I thought was very Grant Morrison and very cool. Like
that was almost something that worked a little better in animation.
And see, the key thing, it's even better because of the traveling scientist, because you shouldn't leave your key line around.
Yeah, I mean, the key thing...
That's the only thing that makes that line worth it.
Yeah. Well, the key thing actually was expanded in the animated version. The cartoon, the comic, it didn't, you know, there wasn't as much to it. It was, it's a white dwarf matter, that's it. They didn't show the android smashing when he tried to pick it up or anything like that. So
well, but that's fine. Like, that's all you need. And I think that, you know, for Grant Morrison, it was just like, how, you know, what would be a funny way for Superman to lock his door, you know, to leave the key under the mat, except it wouldn't be a regular key. It would be, you know, it would weigh hundreds of thousands of pounds.
I guess this sort of, how do I say this without sounding awful? I think that All-Star Superman shows that, and not in a bad way, but, Grant Morrison's kind of like Alan Moore light, and Alan Moore has
just thinking that
he has that same sort of. This All Star Superman could have very well just have been written by Alan Moore, but it would have. You don't think so?
No, I'm going.
The white dwarf matter, the way that he uses science as a mechanism for, you know,
everything.
But I mean, so I don't. It really doesn't have a point. It's just something that comes across in watching this and in rereading the book. And I love it. I love All Star Superman because I had to read it twice. The first time I read it, I'm like, huh? Yeah. It's like one of those. It's like any Grant Morrison thing. Upon, you know, rereading it, it makes more sense. And
I rewatched All Star Superman this afternoon prior to just talking about this, and I did pick out, you know, what seemed to be throwaway comments and references, which are actually foreshadowing things that come later in the film. You know,
like one thing that's in the film that's different than, not that I want to chronicle things that are different, but in the film, Lois says he kind of looks like my father. Well, or you know, as far as the Superman, the descendant
in, yeah, the future, yeah.
Cal Kent.
Yeah, in the comic, Superman says the time telescope is to speak to his successors, and in this, it's to speak to his descendants. And the whole bit about looking like his father was left out. I do wish they had left in the unknown Superman, the Superman that had the bandaged face.
Superman from the future. That's another story that didn't make it in there.
But I mean,
you got a piece of that though, because you got him visiting Jonathan's grave, and that's all you got of that part. But yeah, it would have been awesome if they could have fit it in.
And to me, that scene right there, it felt a little cold to me. He knew he was dying. He's meeting up with his mother for the last time, and it just didn't seem like he was resolving anything with her. It just felt cold and useless.
That's true. And that might have been a sort of 60s mentality, because men didn't cry. You know, I mean,
right.
I mean, yeah. that could have just been very well, you know, indicative of the time.
But you know, the greatest thing about All-Star Superman is that we got this doomed planet. Desperate scientists, last hope, kindly couple, Superman.
Yeah, honestly, though, the one thing I don't like is that in the version they intersperse that with the sun mission in the comic. It's just a flashback, like a 4-panel flashback of his origin.
And it's a flashback of his origin in the movie too.
But they intersperse it with the sun mission though.
Yeah, and then that's because if you look at it, it's like all the commentaries about doomed planet shows you the fiery sun, and then desperate scientists to the scientists.
Yeah,
I
totally get that. Yeah. It's just. I guess I was expecting. That to be a little more slavish to the.
It's not slavish, you know. For all that. I mean, I think I just sort of distilled it down by saying everything that is good about this, pretty much everything, is the stuff that comes from the comic, and where it falls down is in this in the what's the word?
Being forced into animated form.
No, the
translation
sacrifices. I guess is the sacrifices it had to make to translate itself into animation.
But I guess this is going to be Dwayne McDuffie's last major published work.
I think it's a great thing to go out on. I mean, I think it really succeeds. Yeah. It succeeds more on an emotional and thematic level. It's on a mythological level, because I mean, of course, the idea is that Superman is our modern myth, as Hercules was, or Samson was, or Atlas was, or all these historical mythological figures. That is what Superman is to our world of literature, and that's the side of Superman it tries to capture. I think it falls down a little as a complete narrative, because it's unable to give the time needed over to the labors and tasks aspect, but doesn't dedicate itself entirely enough to the core story. It sits in an uneasy middle ground between just doing the core narrative, which would make more sense for a film, and trying to do the labors aspect, which is where the whole myth idea comes from. To not be perfect, but I think just emotionally, it succeeds.
Where does it compare to, say, some of his other work? He did Crisis on Two Earths?
Yeah,
it's better than that.
That was one of them.
Yeah, Crisis on Two Earths was good, I thought.
It was very good.
Yeah. But it was good the way the Justice League cartoon was good.
Who did Wonder Woman? Did Dwayne McDuffie work on it?
Gail Simone.
Did Gail Simone do that one? Okay.
Yeah, somebody else wrote it with her. But.
So I got a question for you. In the comic book, how played out was the love triangle with Lois, Superman, and Samson and Atlas?
It was about like it is in the comic.
That could have been totally thrown out of the movie. I did not care for. I mean, these are time travelers, right? Is Lois Lane that special? The woman that they're all fighting over her. I mean, they could go to any time and place and go find a woman.
Superman is God walking the earth, and this is his woman. If you can lay his woman, you are God himself.
I know, but
woman with powers like her are rare even in our times. He says,
"Well,
yeah, so
yeah, but I
can understand
that sequence either." And
I just thought it was ridiculous and over the top. I'm like, these guys could go get any woman in any century, and they're
so could Superman.
Lois?
And it,
you know, they don't. I don't think they really want Lois. I think they just
yeah.
Want
they're here to shake their. They're here to shake their dicks at Superman. They're not.
Yeah,
here
that's
to,
what it is. That's all. Lois.
I didn't like it for two reasons. For one, I didn't like it because, like I said, it was. I think it. I mean, and I guess if you're saying it's rooted in that Silver Age, okay. But I do think that concept of, you know, winning a woman through deeds is a bit dated. And I don't mind
just
so much
bit.
That the characters
that's
said that.
That's
the two guys said
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
What I didn't like was the fact that Lois is like, yeah, that's a great idea. I'm
no,
like,
she's
oh,
not.
She's giving him hell. She's giving
she doesn't know
Superman
that he's
shit that's, for lying yeah. to her for 20 yeah. years.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other
she's letting
yeah.
him do it.
She didn't like Clark until she found out she was Superman. I'm like, you're such a user. Ugh.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm saying.
So like, Rachel Lewis was a user, yes.
In terms of...
Oh, Lois Lane is a bitch. Of, like, is it?
I used to not...
That's why I like... That's why, as much as I hate to admit it, that's why I like Smallville better, because I like that
oh, God.
Version of Lois better. You
know? Oh, God, the new episode of Smallville was messed
it was
up.
Terrible. Wasn't it terrible?
It was yeah, it was
terrible.
Awful.
So horrible. Not that we're going to talk about that on the show. But
no,
anyway,
we're not. No, we're not.
All-Star Superman, and he died at the end. Okay.
On an artistic level, I think that this one did a surprisingly good job of capturing Frank Whiteley's... not style, if you know what I mean. Because I mean, it's like we've had the previous Batman and Superman movies that have directly adapted Ed McGuinness and Michael Turner's artwork. Frank Quitely, you'd never be able to accomplish that. He's just...
Right.
Whereas Ed McGuinness and Michael Turner tend to work with pretty clean, minimalist sort of lines. Frank Quitely... I always say that a Frank Quitely person looks like they're made out of melting wax.
Yes. Honestly, watching this, I was thinking Steve Dillon for some reason. It's like, wow, this looks like Steve Dillon. Like they think Steve Dillon did the art.
Oh, God, they need to do a Preacher movie next. Heck
yeah.
Not everybody had the same face, so it wasn't Steve Dillon.
That is true.
Wow.
But I think just the general simplified line work did a surprisingly good job of capturing the feel of Quitely artwork without being slavish to it. I think he did a very good job on that, too.
Now, we need an Earth 2 and a new X-Men. film and
but anyway, like I said, Superman died, so that was great.
No, he didn't. He's a
piece. He lives with that
massive
image.
He's fixing the sun.
Yeah. He's fixing the sun.
Man, like a very like,
every time she said that, I want to actually just put a bullet in her brain. I'm like, shut up. I'm sorry. I did not care for Lois. I did not care for Lois whatsoever in this movie.
Thank
she
you. Yeah.
Oh, she drove me nuts. She's like the type of woman I'm like want to bitch slap all the time. Like, ooh.
Well, I didn't think
See,
that.
I knew I had Nicole on the show for a reason.
I didn't really think Christina Hendricks gave a great performance as Lois. Now, to be fair,
she's no Dana Delaney.
But the writing is still the issue. I mean, it's how that character is written.
No, but I mean, just generally, like the delivery of a bunch of her lines seemed very. Very considered and not just basically sounded like somebody who wasn't used to voice acting. You know, somebody didn't
well,
quite
which it happens a lot.
That happens a lot. I mean, look at, I mean, you know, and that's exactly well. Talk about retro conversation, but like that's exactly like what 10 years ago, like what Michael Bell said about you know working with Judd Nelson in the Transformers.
I just spent hours with him. Andrea Romano, as a director, is usually able to get the best out of him. And I don't know, I forget the name of the guy who played Superman. I just know he plays Mike on Desperate Housewives. But, I mean, I didn't recognize
You watched Desperate Housewives?
I did not say that.
It's on right after My Little Pony.
Of course.
But he gave a really, really great understated performance of Superman. Really quiet, reserved performance, and I really enjoyed But I didn't think Hendricks did a really particularly great job as Lois Lane.
What about Lex Luthor? We didn't even really mention Lex Luthor in this.
No,
I love
it. I like the voice actor that did Lex. I thought he did a good job with it.
I loved Lex Luthor in this.
Lex
has like no consistency across animation. Every actor who does Lex has a different take on how to do Lex. But Lex has gone through a lot of different characterizations because Grant Morrison gives us the old Silver Age mad scientist, underground mad scientist Lex Luthor, who has been out of vogue since the early 80s. You know,
see, that's the thing. I wanted more Lex. They should have been more Lex in this story than pretty much anything else. I wanted to see more of his story.
Well, they did literally take everything with Lex in it from the comics. There was nothing else to,
yeah,
put in. Yeah. You
know, so I guess as a take on Lex, this is closer to what? Sort of Gene Hackman?
No, God, no.
Well, I mean, no, he lives underground.
He had the water scheme, remember, with his son? Yeah, that's definitely
that
Gene Hackman right there.
No. God. He didn't try to kill Superman by building more land.
Yeah.
It's a water shortage. He's going to make money off of that.
Yeah, that's very... Yeah, exactly.
That is. But that's a hell of... Well, yeah, but he was going to do that by manipulating the energies of the sun, not putting a bit of kryptonite on a necklace.
Okay, while we're on the subject of Lex, what was the point of his niece being in there? They introduced her. She really didn't do anything but take Superman on a boat ride.
That was definitely the point of just saying, I dug this obscure character out of some issues of Supergirl, and look at what I know. I think was really...
I honestly didn't see the point of her character even being in the show, besides wearing a stupid helmet. That thing was horrible.
I can't disagree with that one.
So basically, if you've read All-Star Superman, this is good. If you like Superman, this is good. If you don't like Superman, it's meh.
It's not going to convince you that he's great or anything.
Well, okay. The thing is, I was excited because people were hyping it up. This is the death of Superman. I'm not a big Superman fan, but people were telling me, okay, this is going to be good. And I was expecting this big, huge superhero movie, and I didn't get it. I got a couple action scenes, and that was it. And I'm like, why can't we have more scenes like when he was fighting the parasite? I liked that scene. That was awesome.
That was my least favorite scene.
No, that was good. I like that.
I've definitely heard that complaint from a couple of people, and that's fair enough, but that's just not what this story is. I mean, if some people were expecting something differently, you know, I'm not going to say that's their fault for expecting something that the movie isn't, but that's not what the story is, so that's just an area where...
It's just Superman being awesome. That's what it is. And if you like Superman, you'll love it.
If you're like my brothers who like love Silver Age Superman and concept, this you'll probably like this.
It's about straddling the line between super and man.
I mean, honestly, I would much rather have this than Grounded. Walking around. Yeah. Oh my God. Let me see him have a Sun Eater as his pet. I'd rather have that than him walking to Connecticut.
Yeah, fair enough. I think I'll try and read this and then maybe rewatch it at that point. So,
but, I think that's what I'm going to have to do.
There you go. So,
there's only one Superman in my eyes, and that's Christopher Reeve's Superman.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's a good choice.
You should go back and read the Geoff Johns Superman then, or the stuff that he did with Richard Donner.
We discussed a couple months ago that like this would be the version of Superman and Lex and stuff that I liked, and it was really close as far as like Lex, but not quite. So I think I'm still going to have to write my Superman story and go with that.
You need to read Red Sun next. Okay. Maybe that's your Superman, you know, Russian Superman.
I haven't read Red Sun in years. I need to.
Maybe Russian. So anyway, so that's our show, Fanboy Versus. A couple of things. Again, we are doing the Fanboy Versus Sparring Editions. We're slowly rolling those out. But that's where we do reviews of things that we don't talk about on the show. I've actually started to do some text reviews over on CNI. Speaking of CNI, it's Comic News International, comicnewsi.com. We're partnered with them, and I've started to post some reviews and things over there as well.
Stream live there.
We do stream live there when I remember to post it. which I didn't do today. But I'll make a note to do that, of course, next time. So, so Comic News Eye, we do appreciate them as well. And like I said, check out our YouTube channel for the sparring edition. I think you said, Mephila, you were going to do a wrap-up for...
I feel like I want
to. Fantastic Four. That would be awesome. I don't have anything for this week because I reviewed everything, although I'll try and do some text reviews of what I read. But I might do... At some point, I'm going to do my review of some of the Spider-Man 2099, so we'll see about that. But anyway, once again, I want to mention, if you're interested in interviews, again, we've got the Troy Hickman interview that went up this week. A couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Dan Juergens. Check those out. Share those with your friends. Tell people about them. Tell people about this show. We want to be out there and try and reach more people. So, Brian, thanks for... talking on the show today.
I'll shut up next week and I'll just press buttons.
you know, we like having you on every once in a while, but, you know, I know that it's hard to get into comics.
We've got to look good in front of the boss, right?
Yeah.
JD?
Who's in the pool? Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, there you go. That's the show. Anything else real quick before we go?
Nope. I think we did.
I read Ultimate Captain America number 2. Don't do the same thing. Don't do the same. I read Ultimate Captain America number 2. Don't make the same mistake I did.
Okay.
It has Nuke in it, though.
I caved in and bought Marvel vs. Capcom 3. Please do make the same mistake.
Hey, what did you get it on? You got Xbox or you got
PS3?
Dadgummit! Get an Xbox.
why did you get it on? Why did you get it on the Xbox instead of the PS3?
Not having an Xbox.
Well, no, triplet.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, I have an arcade stick.
Ah, yes, okay. And you hoped that I would get it, too. That's probably the other.
Oh, yeah.
So check out all those reviews on New Soundwave. And, yeah.
Sorry. All
right. So thanks, Brian, McFeely Triplett, and Nicole for joining us. Again, I'm JD. And please tune in next time when it'll be Fanboy versus...
This has been Fanboy Versus with your hosts, JD Church, Chris McFeely, Chris Triplett, and Brian Kilby. Visit us at tfradio.net for show notes and to subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter at TF Radio for news and updates. Like the podcast? Leave us feedback on iTunes. Copyright 2010, Radio Free Cybertron.